I do think that medicine as we have known it is under threat. The private aspect of medicine, the idea that you are a private individual with a personal physician, and that the relationship is private and is confidential, I think that's under threat now. Yeah. So I'm very, very worried about that, being a doctor of 30 years' experience. Well, my background is diverse. I'm not your normal doctor. I graduated in medicine in 1976, and I practiced medicine for 30 years all up on the front line of medicine. I mainly worked in adult medicine. I didn't really look after children much at all, apart from the first year or two. So I specialised pretty much in adult medicine, and I also had a lot of experience in geriatric. And I practiced medicine at a very high level. We used a lot of technology, a lot of screening, and saved a lot of lives, as doctors do as a matter of course. It's pretty much what you do for a living. But I got bored with medicine, and then I branched out, and I started a company which in about 1990, and that company became quite a large biotechnology company, and it specialized in the genetic engineering of microorganisms. At the time, we were genetically engineering bacteria, and that still goes on today. We weren't working with viruses in 1990. The technology, even in 1990, of genetically manipulating bacteria was quite advanced and quite relatively mature, and the company I founded had a large fermentation plant, so we were growing these organisms in large volumes. And then we became a manufacturer of restriction enzymes, which are the tools of trade for genetic engineering. And then we slowly morphed into becoming an anti-cancer therapeutics company. I got a little bored with that, and my usefulness to the company ended because I didn't really have any role eventually, and because it was very, very high tech. I went back to practicing medicine, and then I got involved in another project where we started a company to map the internet. And that company was the first company in the world to map the internet, what's called IP address to geographic location. So prior to that, we didn't know where anybody was on the internet. People don't realize that today, but prior to the year 2000, we really did not know where people were on the internet. It was relatively anonymous in terms of location. But we developed a map. It was extremely clever technology to map the internet. And then eventually then I retired from medicine. I went to live in Europe. I've lived in Europe quite a lot. And then eventually, under the urging of quite a few people, I started a global finance and economics newspaper. And it is not aimed to the general public. It is aimed very much at the highest levels of economics and finance, particularly at people who are in central banking or advisors to central banks or very significant fund managers, professors of finance, professors of economics. That's my readership. And I started that in about 2015, and I have quite amazing list of readers, all of whom are in that sort of group. So I write an editorial once a week, like a letter to my readers, and its focus is mainly on the subject of money, because money is an ill-understood subject. Most people just don't understand it. The world of economics certainly largely ignores it, and quite frankly, doesn't understand it well at all. So that's my sort of little sub-specialty in finance and economics. And then finally, the world of COVID-19 turned up in 2020. And I had been really waiting for the coronavirus, the next iteration of coronavirus, to turn up somewhere in the world and at obvious places in Asia. So I was not at all surprised by the whole coronavirus outbreak. And I, quite frankly, not been very surprised since then. A lot of what has happened in the last 2.5 to 3 years is what I expected. There are some very odd things that have occurred, which perhaps I didn't anticipate. And that would be the peculiar nature of the epidemiological spread of this virus. It doesn't seem to spread like a normal virus. But apart from that, I wasn't really surprised by this event. I knew, for instance, that coronavirus manipulations had been occurring for up to 15 years in both Wuhan and in the United States, and that they'd been working together for that. So I wasn't surprised by this. And I knew immediately this was not a bat soup virus. You know, the idea that there was some missing pangolin that was the intermediate host, immediately I thought, well, this is ridiculous. You know, this is clearly not a a natural mutation passed through a pangolin. So I then started looking for doctors who might be interested in this. I was out of touch with the world of medicine, and I found a group of doctors who were interested in trying to reveal the truth. And ever since then, I've helped them a great deal in trying to bring some truth and, let's say, some sanity to the whole COVID world or COVID debate. I assisted them in starting a newspaper called the cmnnews.org newspaper, and that publishes a lot of articles on COVID that come from all over the world. So that brings us to the present day, and of course, we're in a very unusual part of the viral epidemic and the release of the vaccines now. So everything's evolved to a higher level now. But so I've got a very diverse background that allows me to sort of look at all the various features of what's happening in the world today. I'm also very interested in geopolitics because they play a very large role in everybody's lives. So I've got a very broad range of interests. I'm just not your normal doctor. That's my background. So
why do you think it seems so difficult for so many people to wrap their minds around this kind of what seems to be a full-scale violent invasion, an assault enacted on their agency, their sovereignty, and bodily integrity as human beings? I think we both agree that the way mainstream media frames the COVID-19 narrative, it's woefully inadequate. It's very narrow. And it seems to me largely representative of huge international finance and banking interests. So to what extent do you see the present financial restructuring of the world economy as related to the ongoing COVID crisis and the claimed necessity of injecting people ad infinitum with these experimental platforms?
Okay, well, a lot of questions there, a lot of subjects. Okay, where do we start? Let's start first with what you said about how do people not see what's happening? To me, it's crystal clear what's happening, but to most people, it's not, because they don't have my background. I think the average citizen in the Western world has become very much dumbed down in the last 20 to 30 years. They have very little real knowledge of things such as history, the banking system, how their economy works, how energy is used in an economy, how the healthcare system operates, how money gets created and destroyed and used in an economy. I could go on and on. There are so many things that people don't understand about the world they live in. And I summarize this in one term. I refer to it as being comfortably numb. So I think the advanced economies, the people in the advanced economies are comfortably numb. Their lifestyles are almost magical in quality. For instance, they can on their telephone, they can ring anybody in the world for free. They can look at some online merchant and order a new set of headphones or a new computer, and it'll be delivered to their door by a delivery man in a day or two. They just pay for it by clicking the mouse. There's a lot of elements of magic there. You know, I want it, I click it, I get it. I mean, that's magic, really. And it would have been seen as magic in the past. We just presume it's normal now. But this contributes to this comfortably numb materialistic world that we live in, where we don't have to be concerned, most of us, about food or water. We've got adequate heating. We've got adequate cooling. We've got air-conditioned cars. We've got, you know, everything's on tap. Everything's on tap. So this makes people comfortably numb. And the famous song by Deep Floyd, Comfortably Numb, is particularly interesting because nearly everybody has heard that. And it vibrates and resonates with people. When I talk to them about being comfortably numb, they know immediately the song, and they know that, yes, yes, we're comfortably numb. So when it comes to very complex matters, they're just not prepared to deal with them. And the world of finance, economics, medicine, virology, epidemiology, pharmacology, all of this is extremely complicated. And the average citizen is just living this magical life where everything's delivered. They don't need to know anything about all these subjects. And then on top of that, they've got a mainstream media that seems to just, it washes them in a whole lot of things that are actually, that are unreal, but which they call reality television. And then on top of that, they've got social media platforms which purposely being swayed or bent to change their perception of things. They're like, they're almost like mirrors. They're looking at these mirrors all the time, which we call a mobile phone, but it's actually a mirror. So they're getting their biases confirmed over and over again. They only listen to things that confirm their view of the world. And that's a very dangerous situation. If you're just endlessly confirming your bias, you're never really learning anything. So you're getting deeper and deeper and deeper into this comfortably numb world. And then when something comes along that's a threat to that, it's actually creates almost a cognitive dissonance. You know, the people don't like, they go, oh, I don't want to know the truth. No, the truth is scary. I don't want to know. No, I'd rather be told, I'd rather believe the narrative, the mainstream media and the politicians have told me. I'm more comfortable with that. And so what I always say about this is that the reality of that people have may be very distorted and very, very unreal or incorrect or non-truthful, but it's their reality. It's the reality they have created for themselves. And if you threaten that in any shape or form, then how can they really change their view? And so that generates this thing called cognitive dissonance. And cognitive dissonance is basically anxiety and fear that springs out of these challenges to their world that they think is real because they've created it. I'm sort of getting deeper and deeper into the comfortably numb story here, but that's the first part of your question, I think. And then you have to ask the question, is this being purposely created? Well, I happen to think it has been purposely created, because if you look at the ownership of publishing companies, mainstream media companies, they've fallen into fewer and fewer and fewer hands. So I think there's agendas that are serving the purposes of the owners of all of this media, which really don't serve the purposes of the people. And all of this has been slowly, slowly happening over 30 years. I first started noticing that people couldn't think critically before the year 2000. I was still a doctor. I was practicing medicine. I would come home at night and I'd say to my wife, I'd say, they're not thinking clearly. I'm having trouble with my patients. They don't seem to be able to think critically. So I began to notice this decline in critical thinking. So that was we're 20 years into this, at least 20 years into that. And it's not getting any better. The mainstream media is completely allied to a single narrative of the world. They don't like debate. They don't seek debate. They don't seek any pursuance of the real truth at all. So I think it's all getting worse. And then on top of it, that all getting worse, you then add threat, a major threat. And the media can then blow that threat up and say, look, you're all going to die from this terrible, terrible virus. Even though that's not true, most people just had no way of judging it. But I'll explain to you that, for instance, we had a Diamond Princess event, a big cruise ship that tied up in Japan in February, March 2020. And we knew exactly how many people were on board that ship. And we knew that this virus was spreading around that ship. And we didn't give them any treatment. They were all locked in the ship. Food was passed into the ship. They were locked up for some weeks in that ship. And eventually it all came to an end and they let them go. But we now know, and we knew then, by the way, we knew that the death rate on a population basis of who was on that ship. And the death rate was 0.35%. Locked in a ship, everybody in a ship, everyone locked, everyone enclosed, with the air conditioning running, with almost no contact with the outside world, with no treatment, the death rate was 0.35% on a population basis. Now, if you look at the death rate on a population basis in the world now, which is nearly 3 years on, of this virus, of this horrible, horrible threat, which was blown out of all proportion, if you look at the death rates of the top 20 nations in the world, guess what? 19 of them have a death rate around 0.35%. So we knew all this 3 years ago before the panic began. There's only one nation that's got a higher rate, and that's Peru. And they have a 0.6% death rate per million population. So it's, for some reason, was higher than everybody else. I don't know why. But the other 19, they're all around 0.3%. So despite everything that's happened in the last almost 3 years, death rate per population from this terrible, horrible virus is the same as we had in the Diamond Princess. And there are 158 nations in the world. So therefore, 138 nations had death rates way below the Diamond Princess rate. And if you look at countries like Nigeria, there's a whole host of them, had almost no deaths at all. Like, instead of having X thousand numbers of deaths, they had like 15 per million. Instead of 6,000 per million, they had 15. So there's a huge variability of outcome as well, but in that lower mortality area. So the perception of the threat was hyped to the maximum, absolute maximum. And when you've got people who are comfortably numb and you threaten them with some scary thing that's going to kill them, and they can't judge how big the threat is, and you amplify all of that by using a test called a PCR test and you create all these ACE numbers, then it basically generates cognitive dissonance. That cognitive means that you can't think properly. People just couldn't think their way through this. They didn't have the skill to do it, and they were being threatened and scared the whole time. And the second thing that happens when people get threatened and scared is they become more suggestible. So they're more willing to take suggestions, such as, oh, it's safe in effect, and they just grab it because they're willing to grab hold of anything when they're in a state of panic. So suggestibility rises when you can increase suggestibility with a lot of things, but fear and anxiety will generally raise suggestibility. And that's what happened. And people just grabbed onto this, oh, safe and effective, we'll just do this. So this was sold to them when, for instance, they sold it on the basis of 95% effective. But effective at what? Effective at what? Well, effective at creating some sort of antibodies, I guess. And that percentage is what's called relative risk reduction. And if you look at the absolute risk reduction, it's less than 1%. So the absolute risk reduction is the amount of reduced risk you'll get on a population basis if you were to have this jab. So it's not 95% effective in the population. And now we've had that admitted in the European Parliament that they didn't really check for transmission of the virus. And these ideas that this vaccine can prevent transmission 95% just disappeared in a puff of smoke about 2 months ago in the European Parliament. But I knew that. And I knew that in December 2020, I got the clinical trial papers that were released by the companies and I read them. And I immediately got out my pen. I didn't need $20 billion to work this out. I got out this pen. I got an envelope. And on the back of the envelope, I calculated the relative risk reduction. And then I calculated the absolute risk reduction. And the absolute risk reduction of one of the products was 0.7% and the other one was 1.3%. I knew immediately that these products would not protect the population because the absolute risk reduction was too low. And I knew that within 10 minutes, that all I needed was one pen and one envelope. So, of course, I was not surprised by this. But once you light the flame of panic and fear and then you throw people a rescue strategy, then they'll grab it two hands. And that's what they did. They thought, well, we can get injected. This will save us. But, of course, the injection then carries significant risks, which they don't know about and they weren't told about. There's no informed consent going. That opens another whole subject matter. You also asked me about the financial world. I don't think there's been a huge impact on the financial world just yet. We did have a very significant correction in the stock markets of the world. The economies of the world did get hit pretty hard during this whole episode, but that's all to be expected. I don't think any of that was unexpected, and it's just a reaction to what was happening, and you'd expect that to happen. You'd expect people to sell stocks and sell bonds and maybe sell property and, you know, go to cash as a safety, and you'd expect economies to suffer when people are locked up and people fearful. So all of that, I think, is pretty much explainable. We can explain all that in the financial world. I don't think there's been any really big, significant event yet in the financial world, and it may not come. But we can perhaps talk more about that.
Well, there seems to be some talk that the vaccines, there seems to be the perception that the vaccines are related to the proposed green passes or green passports. And this is, of course, related to our ability to move throughout society, to move across borders, and to hold jobs. I think we saw over the past couple of years how your willingness to line up and obey and accept these injections is related to your employment status, your ability to make money, have an income, your ability to travel. All of these seem to be related to all of the things that we take for granted in society as people who have jobs and families are reduced to these decisions of whether or not we accept this sort of totalitarian medicalized rule over our lives.
Yeah, you brought up a few things there. Firstly, a lot of what you've brought up there boils down to the conflict between what we call public health and private health. So my private health and your private health is your business. The fact that you've got a pimple on your left big toe is none of my business, and it's none of the business of the government. That's private health. The fact that you may have a cancer of the left lower lung is your business. It's got little to do really with anyone else. It's your problem, along with your private medical advisors. So that's private medicine and private health. What's public health? Public health is very, very different. And the world of medicine, quite frankly, has not been involved much at all in public health. Doctors who practice medicine don't give much thought to this world of public health at all. They practice medicine. They diagnose illness and disease. They manage illness and disease. They treat people when they need to. Private health world up to now has pretty much been a disease catch and capture system. It's a disease system, it's not a health system. And it's very important because there's a lot of disease in the human race. And there's literally a great conveyor belt of disease that's passing through doctors' offices all the time. You know? And they've got to deal with it. And it's a big job dealing with all of that. So that's private health on an individual basis. And we used to have things that sanctified the doctor-patient relationship and kept everything private in that consulting room. And the doctor's records were private. But slowly but surely, governments have decided they want to be in that room. And one of their best weapons is this idea that there's a public health threat, which they have to apply public health measures to. And this is what's happened. It's basically an attack on the people, in my opinion, based upon, in this case, a relatively false threat. It was no serious threat. But they either purposely created this circumstance or they let it go completely to extremes which should not have happened. And they tasted world of totalitarian control. They got a taste of it. It's a bit like giving the dog a piece of pork at the dinner table. The dog will like it and he'll come back for more. That's what happened to the people who are in government and power. They tasted the magical potion of totalitarianism. And if you think carefully about the people who are attracted to politics and government, both in public service positions and in political positions, they are people who are self-selected on the basis that they seek power over other people. And they're very rare. These are a very small group of people in society who seek public office, either as a public servant or as a politician. But this group who are self-selected on the basis of their desire for power got a taste of totalitarian power, and they took it to ridiculous extremes, locking people down, mandating vaccines for certain jobs, QR codes on phones, stopping people entering restaurants and cafes. And then finally, it manifested in what you call the vaccine passport. And this is just a ridiculous way to run a world. You can't run a world like that. But it very rapidly then devolves into what I would call medical fascism. And fascism was summed up by Mussolini, I think, the best of all. Fascism is the fusion of the state and the corporate world to get totalitarian power over the people. So this fusion between the corporate world and the state is what fascism is. And we ran headlong as a society into this fascist world of corporate and government control of our lives. And because most people were comfortably numb and so scared and fearful, they ran into it. They didn't walk. They didn't hesitate. They rushed into this medical fascism. And I tell people that democracies won't protect you from the tyranny of the 51%. So in a democracy, you can wind up with 51% of the people rigidly controlling the other 49%. So in that case, you don't have a protection against tyrannical, power-hungry politicians, and you just fall into medical fascism. You basically fall over the line into this. And then you get up as a society and you look around and you think, how the hell did this happen? And a lot of people are having those thoughts now. A lot of people are beginning to wonder, well, what the hell happened? So that's where we're up to today. So we're in a situation where we've surrendered human rights. We've ended up in a world of medical fascism. We've ended up with the taste of totalitarian power in the mouths of our politicians and public servants. And we now have to engage in the long fight back toward our human rights and toward what democracy should be.
I've been doing some research, as you know, on propaganda for some time now. I'm interested in it, and specifically on how populations are propagandized to involve themselves in war efforts. There's a little known story in American history in the early part of the 20th century. I'm not sure if you're aware of this fact, but retired U.S. Marine Corps General Smedley Butler, he's the author of that famous tome, War is a Racket. He delivered a televised public address in, I think, 1935 about an attempted fascist coup d'etat of the U.S. government. And it was plotted by big finance and industrial interests. So he called attention publicly to the conspiracy because he had been secretly invited to serve as the figurehead of what was supposed to be a corporate-led American fascist state. So, you know, from your perspective and your experience, where do you see this bizarre reordering of societies around the world leading to? And what do you think is driving it all?
All very big questions, Daniel. You're good at posing very big questions. I haven't watched that video by Smedley Butler or read anything he's written. I've heard that the famous quotes he made, so I can only comment laterally to it. But 1935, of course, was a very interesting time in history. In 1933, the Reichstag was burnt down and Hitler grabbed power in Germany. And he did that on a date which I'll always remember. And then he used that again, that threat of, to the people, and he called it a threat, and he went straight to the head of state and he asked for an enabling act to be passed. And that enabling act basically allowed him to control Germany and override Parliament, because Parliament had been burnt down. So he was able to then create the emergency. That's conjecture. Did he create the emergency? But he took advantage of whatever happened. And then he went to the head of state and the enabling act was passed and signed by the head of state. So at that point, he became a totalitarian dictator of Germany. So Smedley Butler was writing and talking a couple of years after that. And of course, World War I preceded that. So World War I, of course, led to millions of men dying. I think it was well over 10 million died in the trenches. And it petered out at the end because they just thought, well, maybe it's not a good idea to continue. So we've got this historical background of World War One, the reparations issues for Germany afterwards, leading to they had a hyperinflation event where their economy just completely collapsed, where their currency completely collapsed in particular. And they were all destitute and starving, and a fascist political party was able to grab power with the burning down of the Parliament building. So when Smedley Butler was writing about all of that, that was all the background. That's the perspective to what he was referring to. And he said that there was an attempt to run another fascist coup, but in America. Obviously, that didn't happen. The democratic state continued on. The democracy seemed to have survived it, but very quickly was then overcome by World War II and the events of World War II, which came out of all of that as well. So now, propaganda, the subject you brought up at the start, ties into all of this because the most famous propagandist in the world is Goebbels from the Nazi group that took control of Germany. He was a great propagandist. He really understood how to project power and certainty to influence the people and to give them hope. So he had a very clear view of all of that. He was clearly a master at propaganda and launched a whole lot of things that the things I was talking about before, the suggestibility of the people, making them feel more comfortable, making them feel more hopeful, making them feel anxious about threats that he projected upon them, and then directing everything to a single solution. There's only one solution, and that solution was, of course, we've got to all back Adolf Hitler and follow into him into a golden future. And those dynamics are very similar to what's happened in the COVID thing. There's only one solution. It's safe and effective. You get a jab. You don't question it. It's the same thing. It's fear, threat, suggestibility, one suggestion, one solution. Therefore, what's happened has elements, very strong elements of propaganda. And I think it's fair to say that what's happened in the last few years is very resonant of what happened in Germany in the 1930s. I hope we're not going to repeat history, but I'm fearful because the same elements are there. And then we might like to say, discuss things that are very concerning about our democracy. For instance, are our elections being run as they should be? People are starting to doubt. Are the elections fixed? Are they rigged? Is there a problem with our democracy? And of course, nobody knows the answer because nobody really understands how these voting systems operate, or we just presume they're being run properly. So we've got this mix of propaganda, circumstance, fear. It's very similar to the 1930s. So Smedley Butler is right sitting in the center of all of that. So he was obviously very worried about fascism and the involvement into fascism from a democratic state. And I am too. because of that 51% risk, that the 51% can become the tyrannical, power-hungry, willing to do anything and justify anything in the pursuit of power. And the other tool they use is the same tool they used in pre-war Germany. They said it's for the greater good. All of this will make you a better life, a better future. It's for the greater good. It's the same lie. And it's not a lie that was invented by Goebbels. That lie is used over and over and over again over the centuries and centuries of history. And the lie is this. They say, okay, to get a better life, we've got to go over that mountain there, kill all of the people in the next tribe, in the next valley, and then we'll have a better life. So we've got to go and do this for the greater good. And this has been the history of warfare, nation states, the formation of nation states, and the conquering of other regions. And the best example of that is, of course, Genghis Khan. He just swept through all of what we now call Eurasia, and you know, all the same techniques were used. And then, of course, the violence begets more violence, and your society starts falling apart right in front of your eyes. So then you've got a very long, as I said earlier, you've then got a very long road back to what we would call a civil society, and a society which might preserve some rights for the citizen against the totalitarian power. So propaganda is part of all of that mix, and I think we've been served a great deal of propaganda in the last 2 to 3 years. And the most striking example is the safe and effective, safe and effective. I met a young man in the middle of all of this, 2.5 year period, and he was from Bosnia, and he had a discussion with me. I gave a community presentation. He came up afterwards, introduced himself, and he said, "I'm Jose," I forget his name, something like Jose, Spanish sort of funny name. Anyway, he said he was from Bosnia, and I didn't know anything about Bosnia. I had a vague idea where it was on the map. But he said something that really struck me. He said, "Did you know that our prime minister last night used exactly the same words as the Bosnian prime minister did the day before?" And I said, "Really?" He said, "Exactly." He said, "I watched the Bosnian prime minister say those words, and within 24 hours, I was watching our prime minister saying those words." He said, "How could this be? Bosnia is a little tiny state in the middle of near Croatia, in the middle of, you know, Eastern Europe. How can the words be the same?" He said, I raised my eyebrows and said, "Well, you tell me, how can that be?" So the words, of course, everybody's heard of safe and effective. Everybody's heard of build back better. Okay. Everybody's heard of we're in all in this together. All of these phrases were identical from nation to nation, from language to language. So that then is a very worrying development, because it sort of suggests that our prime ministers are not really in control of their agendas, that they are being directed. And here we get into the world, I guess, of conspiracy fact.
We've talked a bit before about some possible reasons why so many people around the world, especially in clinical situations and laboratories, can't fully grasp what they're observing in patients. The subjects volunteered to be injected in the blood samples examined under microscopes. Why do you think this phenomenon, this general inability to recognize what's actually there in front of their eyes, continues to persist? Do you think maybe it's willful ignorance? Is it genuine? What are your thoughts about this seeming inability for professionals to wake up and...
Well, this is the $64 billion question. You know, why have our institutions failed? It's pretty much all of our institutions. And the expert world of technology and science and medicine appear to be failing us. There are people who work in those fields, and they just don't seem to notice what's happening. All they can entertain is the official narrative, and they support the official, and they promote it. There's many, 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 many examples of these people. A lot of the most obvious ones are the chief medical officers of various nations and various states around the world, who seem to have no doubt about what they're promulgating. This is very strange, because, of course, and they say things like, "We follow the science." Well, science is all about doubt. Science is all about debate. It's all about listening to the opposition view. Science is about discovering truth through overcoming prior truths. So we're always moving forward to try and find a better truth than what we've already established. It seems that these so-called experts that you're referring to are locked into their view of truth and not willing to even consider anything else. And of course, they often will say, "Oh, they're just conspiracy theories," or they'll say, "Oh, that's just coincidence." I think these people are captured. They're very much captured by official narrative. They have, there's an old saying, don't get between a man and his salary, because he just won't see your argument if his salary or his position in society is threatened. I think that's part of it. There's nothing in it for them to see an alternative. They get rewarded for reconfirming the official narrative over and over again. So this begs the question, are they aware of reality or not? And I actually think they are suffering from a grand delusion. And if they are suffering from a grand delusion, then the whole idea of are they psychotic comes to mind. Because psychosis, the illness we call psychosis, it often revolves around delusional system. Those red cars, they're following me everywhere. You know, everywhere I look, I see another red car, and they're following me. So delusional, psychotic people can construct a very strong view that of the world, such as people in red cars are following, and it's hard to shake them. So that's a paranoid, delusional psychosis. This is different because these people are not clearly mentally ill, but they don't wish to question anything. They only wish to confirm their narrative and their bias. That's not a way to practice science or medicine or anything in what we call civil society. Everything should be up for question. And we've enshrined that over the centuries in things like our belief in free speech, our ability to speak and write. And in our methodologies, we've got things like in science, we've got scientific journals and medical journals. But even those appear to be controlled from what I can tell. So willful ignorance is a very difficult term you've used. I don't think these people are willfully ignorant. I think they're somehow under a spell of some sort or a delusion. And their incentives to abandon that are very few and far between. So they just keep promulgating the story. It's complicated, and I've not witnessed this before in my lifetime. It's disturbing because it means that we've lost the rudder of science and the rudder of technology. But there is a big difference between technology and science. Okay? Science is the seeker of truth. Technology is actually the end result of science. So I'm very concerned that science has been rendered in a damaged state, and therefore future technologies can't really manifest out of a damaged science. That's basic problem. In medicine, we don't practice science. We practice medicine. And that's another distinction. In medicine, we use science as a guideline, as a map, but we don't practice science. Doctors are not scientists. Doctors don't tend to experiment. They're not experimenters. They try to solve people's problems pragmatically through what we call abductive logic. But that's a long way from experimentation. Science is all about experimentation to find the truth and to eliminate untruth. Medicine and science are two different things. Science and technology are two different things. People get these things very confused. You know, when they say follow the science, they're actually saying follow the technology. So these linguistic definitions are really, really important. And because you're a professor of linguistics, I think it would resonate with you the way I'm trying to show these differences. They're very, very important. Doctors are given the role of using a lot of ethics in what they do, using a lot of knowledge from what they do, using a lot of experience in what they do. And quite frankly, the science of it is a relatively small part of it. These distinctions are very, very important. And I think a lot of people in all of these worlds, medicine, technology, science, are confused about what these things are. You know, if I hear someone say, I follow the science, I want to know, well, what science? You don't follow science. Science is a process whereby you question and you experiment to see if you can find a better answer to your question. So you don't follow science. These are really important questions in the situation we're in today. Doctors also don't practice public health, going back to what I said earlier. They practice medicine. So some doctors are mixed up in this world of public health, and I think they are also very confused about a lot of things. It's still a bit of a mystery, the question you've asked, but I hope I've sort of given you some guidelines where you can start to look at it all and say, well, we've got to question these definitions. And by the way, there's been a concerted effort to change definition. There's been a concerted effort to change the definition of an epidemic and the definition of a pandemic and the definition of a vaccine. Why? You have to ask yourself the question, why were these linguistic definitions changed? It doesn't make a lot of sense. It starts to resonate with conspiracy fact, not conspiracy theory. When you're changing the meaning of words that have stood for centuries and you deliberately start changing these definitions, I'm suspicious of that. And I'd like to ask you, as an expert in linguistics, how do you react to these efforts to change these definitions?
Well, I've noticed that as well since I've been writing about the COVID-19 narrative. I have also noticed that certain definitions of key terms and key phrases have been modified, and they seem to have been modified in line with certain market demands for these new products that are coming online. For example, as you noted, the term vaccine has changed quite radically over the past couple of years. I think the most recent change was 2021. The concept of herd immunity has changed. That is probably the most alarming. I think that it might have been the World Health Organization that has updated the term for herd immunity. So these changes, they seem to be in line with the effort, the global campaign to inject 7 million plus people with these new products. And there's a lot of scholarship, actually, in some of the communication theory. There was one of my favorite scholars, Herbert Schiller, used to write about this. The ability to control a narrative is dependent largely upon the ability to control the definitions. To control the definitions of keywords and to apply names to new phenomena in society that are important. So when you have the power to name things and you have the power to define and to redefine and to control the definitions, you have immense power to control the perceptions of the population, perceptions of what's real, what's not real, what's true, what's not true.
Yeah, well, great comments. I agree totally. And I mean, you're the linguistics professor, so I'd certainly listen carefully to everything you've got to say about that. I think it's true. Everything you've said is true. And you've mentioned something about the World Health Organization. And I'd like to say a few things about that, because the important thing there is it's an unelected, non-democratic body. And the people who work for this are not answerable to the people in any democratic sense. They're selected, they're appointed, and they've granted themselves great power over societies that are supposedly democratic. So I'm very worried about the World Health Organization. I'm very worried about other groups such as the World Trade Organization, the IMF, World Bank. Why am I grouping all of those together? Because they all sprang from one meeting in July 1944. And that meeting, the Bretton Woods meeting, which was held in a little village called Bretton Woods in New Hampshire in America. And at that meeting, all of the allies, they basically set up the world we live in today. In that meeting, they set up the world that included the establishment of the IMF, International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, United Nations, the dominance of the US dollar in international trade, or what we call the reserve currency status of the US dollar over the British pound, which it was until then. And all of this happened in this one meeting long before the Second World War ended. And we still live in that world. I actually tell people that we're living in a US dollar empire, and it's not a lot different to the Roman Empire. And it all sprang pretty much from that meeting at Bretton Woods. Two allies, of course, didn't like. One was the UK, and the other one was the USSR. They didn't like this. They said, oh, here's a blatant grab at global power by the Americans. But nonetheless, of course, most of the allies agreed to it, and we're now still living in that world. So when we talk about these non-government organizations, they go all the way back to the period we were talking about, July 1945. Isn't that interesting? Now, when we get on to things like definitions and power, and if you redefine what a vaccine is, and you redefine what a disease is, and you redefine how you're going to diagnose those diseases, and then how you're going to treat them, everything changes in terms of our rights as citizens in a civil society, in a democratic society. So these changes of definitions are critical, and they mainly come from initiatives that spring from non-government organizations that were born in 1944. It'd be amazing. So this can bring us through to a discussion on geopolitics. I don't know if you wanted to get into that, but what's happening today is a problem for this world of the US dollar dominance. So there's a group of nations who are now attempting to break that dominance, and they're very open about it. They are basically the BRICS nations, the BRICS, and the Shanghai Cooperation agreement nations, and they're very unhappy with US dollar dominance in global trade. So they're seeking to change that and make what they call a multipolar world. In other words, a world where not just one currency dominates global trade settlement. And they want more nations to settle their global trade in their own currencies. So we've got a big, let's call it US dollar empire, and we've got the opposition saying, we don't like this and we want to change. This is unipolar, multipolar. It's a big can of worms, it's correct. It sort of mixes into everything you were saying. Is we're playing in dangerous waters when we start to redefine what a vaccine is and what a virus is and what a epidemic is and what a pandemic. These are very, very dangerous. I barely touched the surface on nearly all of those subjects, but we've somehow tried to interweave an answer to your questions. I hope they've been reasonable answers.
Perfect. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the conversation.